Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor, and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I'm joined by my partner in crime in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a contributing writer, I should say, to The Atlantic, and also a distinguished graduate of Harvard College and Harvard University, which will become relevant momentarily. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I think this time, Eric, it's your turn to talk about the jackassery of the week.
Yes, well, I don't want to spend too much time on it because we have a distinguished guest who I want you to introduce, but I would say that, you know, in the week after the pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church passed away unexpectedly.
As a result of meeting Vice President Vance, let us point out.
Immediately after meeting Vice President Vance, whatever you make of that. And while, you know, before the papal conclave has even, you know, had a chance to burn any, you know, white or black smoke, the White House sought to retweet, and the President of the United States saw fit to tweet an AI-generated image of himself as the Pope, thereby justifiably enraging Catholics in the United States and all around the world. And to what particular point? I just don't get it.
Who knows? Well, let me move on to introduce our guest, who is indeed distinguished. I'm going to begin it not in the usual way by reciting a curriculum vitae, but by telling a story. So when I was in graduate school at Harvard University, I joined Army ROTC, and I was commissioned the same time that I got my doctorate in 1982. Now, Harvard had kicked ROTC off campus during the Vietnam era. And so all of us, there were one or two graduate students, but mainly undergraduates, would take the bus to MIT, and we went through ROTC there. And we were commissioned aboard the USS Constitution in Boston Harbor, which was pretty neat. But 22 years later, my oldest son was being commissioned, was graduating Harvard College, was being commissioned as an infantry officer in the United States Army. But something was different this time. This time, the commencement was held in Harvard Yard the day before Harvard commencement. The Harvard band was playing, and the 27th president of Harvard presided. And he gave a speech, which I remember very well, in which he said, we're strong because we're free, but let us remember that we're free because we're strong. And it was a moving speech. He talked about each of the Harvard graduates serving in Iraq, some of whom had been wounded. And frankly, it meant more, I think, to me and to my son than the events of the next day. And it's why I'm particularly pleased that our guest today is Larry Summers, the 27th president of Harvard. Incidentally, the 71st Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. But it's a real honor to have you with us. And so welcome. We'd like to talk to you about, obviously, economics, which is your specialty, which you're, as everybody knows, extraordinarily distinguished, but actually spend most of our time talking about the university world, in which you have enormous experience and in which you have strong views as well. So welcome, President Summers, and I'm going to hand you over to Eric Edelman to begin talking about economics.
Very glad to be with you, Elliot. And I have learned an enormous amount from your writings over the years. And I was pleased to serve in government alongside Eric during my years in the Clinton administration when he was involved in working with Stroke Talbot on issues relating to NATO expansion.
Well, Secretary Summers, if I could start, you know, one of the reasons we are sitting in, you know, the moment we are in this country is because voters were in the fall of 2024 deeply concerned about inflation. You in the spring of 2021 were extremely prescient and very vocal about some of the things that the Biden administration was doing legislatively to stimulate the economy in the wake of already big stimulation that had come as a result of COVID. Your advice, sadly, was not taken. I wonder if from that experience you have any thoughts about why the Biden folks were so resistant to what turned out to be dead on, you know, analysis of where the economy was heading. What, you know, folks on the Democratic side of the aisle may have learned, if anything, from that experience.
Sure. I obviously felt strongly at the time that the risks were large, and I thought fairly elementary economic arithmetic kind of demonstrated that the bathtub was going to overflow if you provided so much stimulus and so much liquidity as was embodied in the stimulus, bill. In terms of why my advice was not taken, I think you can analyze that at several levels. First, to my surprise, but it was a fact, I was a relatively isolated voice in the spring of 2021. And while I think I was right, and while history has tended to bear me out, it's not unreasonable for an administration to consider the whole chorus of economists and not just consider one dissonant voice. And so to some extent, I think I was tuned out because my voice was dissonant and they decided to go with the consensus, which is not entirely unreasonable as a general principle. Second, I think there were a whole set of political considerations at play. The administration felt that there was a very strong need to do stimulus and to do a whole set of things. And the nature of the political forces within the Democratic Party, particularly in light of the fact that the Democrats had won their Senate majority by arguing for large middle class tax cuts, echoing and raising Trump on what he had proposed, made it politically very, very difficult for them to push moving forward on the much more limited scale that I would have proposed. And I think the third aspect that's probably quite important here is that policymakers and all of us in general in life have a tendency to want to make new mistakes. And in the wake of the 2009 experience, where in retrospect, there was a consensus, I think a correct consensus, that fiscal stimulus in retrospect should have been larger. There was a sense, let's not make the same mistake of having too little fiscal stimulus again. Now, my argument was that perhaps we should have had twice as large a fiscal stimulus in 2009, but nobody thought we should have had six times as large a fiscal stimulus. And that judged relative to the GDP gap that was being filled, the 2021 stimulus was going to be six times as large. So there was plenty of room to think that the Obama stimulus had been too small and to think that this one was excessive. But I think that impulse to make new mistakes rather than to repeat the old ones was something that was important in terms of the dynamics. In any event, I think it's a pretty clear political lesson that inflation is something that's experienced by 100% of the population. And 6% unemployment is something that's experienced by 6% of the population and their families. And so high costs of living have a kind of enormous political salience that is very important. In fact, I think the 2024 election is the third election in my lifetime when a more progressive political project was thwarted because of its failure to adequately control inflation. If inflation had not been breaking out substantially, the very close 1968 presidential election probably would have gone differently. The sense of a country out of control around inflation was a major contributor to Ronald Reagan's victory over Jimmy Carter. And then you had the 2024 election, which in the grand scheme of things was actually a very close election. And if we had not had a substantial cost of living problem in the country, I think the chance is overwhelming that the outcome of that election would have been very different. So I think that there's really a very powerful lesson that I'm not sure Democrats have fully internalized even yet, that inflation and high costs of living are a kind of Achilles heel for progressive politics.
Actually, could I just follow up on that? You know, one thing that that I think contributed to the outcome that we got is people having a sense that the Democrats were kind of gaslighting them, including Democratic economists, were gaslighting them on the fact of inflation. That, you know, there was a lot of denial that, you know, in the same way people were denying the evidence of Biden's mental challenges and aging challenges. People had a sense that, you know, the Democrats were saying, no, you know, there's really no inflation here, but it's not what people were feeling. Is that an unfair criticism, do you think?
I think there's, in some ways there's truth in that. In some ways, I think it is a little bit unfair. It is true that the measured inflation rate, according to our price indices, had come substantially down. We were not looking in the 3 months or the year before the 2024 election at an extremely high rate of measured inflation. That's true. And in that sense, people, the progressive leadership, had a point. I think there are two other points, though, that are probably more important. One is that people actually judge the cost of living. And so you pay a price for the inflation you generated 2 years ago for a long time, as people think of costs of living as high. And the other is a more technical point, which is that for reasons that make good sense in terms of microeconomic theory, we do not count the cost of money as part of the our inflation index. But in terms of lived experience, the mortgage rate you pay on your house, the car loan payment that you pay on your car, is part of what defines lived experience. And interest rates were substantially higher in 2024 than they had been in 2021, in part because of the in large part because of the necessary responses to all the stimulus. And so if you include the cost of money, then the inflation performance was a good deal less favorable than it appeared in the official statistics. And while I would support the way in which the official statistics are constructed, because I think that's better grounded in a variety of economic models, from the point of view of political psychology, the right measure is probably something closer to the old CPI that took account of the cost of money.
I love your notion of the propensity to make new mistakes. I mean, another way of putting it, I suppose, is the bad football referee who makes a terrible call at one end of the field and is being booed relentlessly by the fans, who says, I know It was a terrible call, but in the second half of the game, I'll make an equally terrible call on the other team to even it all up.
There's some element of that kind of thing, which is an understandable part of human nature.
I want to, before we get onto some really important intellectual issues about the state of the university and issues about which I know you have a strong and very well-informed view, I do want to ask you a little bit about our current economic moment. It seems to me that we could be on the precipice of a really dark time economically. I look at the Port of Los Angeles, which is, you know, kind of empty. You've on Twitter been talking about the flight from American assets because we have this kind of triple whammy of the stock market going down, bond yields going up, the dollar going down, all of which are not meant to be happening typically at the same time. So if you could, you know, kind of, this is two questions, I guess, in one is how bad, you know, could this be in terms of shortages, a recession, et cetera? And how much long-term damage do you think is being done to the dollar and what I think Valéry Giscard d'Estaing called the exorbitant privilege that the United States has had from having the world's reserve currency, and which has enabled us to do all sorts of things with sanctions and export controls that have, you know, been useful for the, you know, national security of the United States?
Let me, if I could, say three things, Eric. First, we're not debating about whether we should have neoliberal policies, what the role of globalization is. There are a range of rational positions on just how good, just how free trade is. Even judged from the perspective of a much more economic nationalist approach than the one I would favor. Even judged from that perspective, we have made a variety of dangerous errors in our economic policy. We are inflicting a supply shock wound on ourselves by both raising prices substantially and also reducing people's purchasing power substantially. We're doing something on an incredible scale. The increase in tariffs in the current Trump program is somewhere between 15 and 20 times as large as the increase he engineered during his first term. It takes us back to tariff levels well above Smoot-Hawley. It takes us to tariff levels more than two or three times as high as any other affluent country. It is short-sighted even in terms of competitiveness. 60 times as many people work in industries that use steel as work in the steel industry, and they're manufacturing industries, and we're making them less competitive and less able to create jobs. So this is irrational and unfortunate policy on an epic scale, and markets are recognizing that it is such. That's why we're seeing the kind of capital flight trade where stocks, bonds, the currency, everything moves together in the way that used to be typical and is traditionally thought of for a submerging emerging market. With the only good news coming from a sense that maybe we don't mean it and maybe these policies will be reversed and there will be relenting on the approach. Second thing I'd say is it's very difficult to know what the right economic forecast is. If you go wandering around in traffic with your eyes closed, you might or might not be run over by a car. And so I think it's a mistake for responsible people who are trying to call attention to these errors to express certainty that we're going to have either high inflation or a major recession. We don't know how much persistence there will be in these policies. And, you know, luck smiles often on the United States. So we don't know just what the consequences will be. I think it is worth being very alarmed about the fact that credibility once lost takes a long time to recover. It's like the old story about a forest that takes 30 years to grow and 30 minutes to burn down. On the other hand, I think it's important also to remember that Argentina has gone back to the capital markets 10 times over the last 50 years, and that memories are sometimes short, and that FOMO can replace fear pretty quickly. And so I don't want to make certain predictions of doom just because I'm confident that a mistake is being made. I think the odds are better than 50-50, but not far better than 50-50 that we will have a recession. The data in general is that all kinds of measures of sentiment, of expectations, of plans are pretty down. There's the kind of thing you cite with respect to shipping to ports. On the other hand, the actual hard data on the economy so far has been relatively resilient. People are not abandoning stores en masse. We've seen the stock market come back. One of the most sensitive indicators, data on daily credit card spend, is giving some reasons for concern, but it isn't flashing five alarm recession fire. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see, and it's going to depend upon how determined we are to implement these misguided policies, and it's going to depend upon the broader economic dynamic. But we have surely done ourselves no favor, and surely the general move away from predictable rule of law is something on which we're going to, for which we're going to pay a price. President Trump has a number of times in his commentary or musings, however, whatever you want to call it, has said that he thinks that, well, we may have a recession, we may have a downturn, but it's all worth it for the beautiful world that we're going to create. Economists have pretty extensively studied the record of populist nationalist economic policy, and the data are very clear that it often doesn't start that bad, but it always gets much worse if we persist in it. Argentina was a rich country in 1946, a pretty rich country in 1949, a country in more trouble by 1952, and back to being a developing country by 1960 after a period of populist economic policy. So I think the one thing that's almost certain is that if we persist in a strong way on this path, it will go from troubling to bad to worse to worst. I think that American institutions will hold. I think we will avoid making those errors, but there are no certainties.
Wow. All right. Well, on that cheery note, let's move to another area where there's a lot of foreboding, and that's the universities, in which, you know, you not only served as president and quite a distinguished and significant president of one of the country's great universities, but you've also been commenting about it, observing about it, and thinking about it. And I want to start with our alma mater there, which Harvard, which has just dropped a over 300-page report on anti-Semitism at the university. And you and I have discussed this previously, and I actually just have a piece out now in The Atlantic about this. which, you know, as bad as it is, and it is a very disturbing report, my personal view is that there are even bigger issues at stake here. So I was wondering if you could just begin on this one. You were very outspoken, particularly in the wake of the October 7th, 2023 attacks, and then what then happened on campus, how President Gay dealt with it. Could you just talk a little bit about that, and then we'll take it from there to a broader discussion of the universities, the administration, and so on.
Elliot, I think in some ways, look, the report is a harrowing document. It describes large numbers of instances in which people are harassed, are mistreated in egregious ways that just are unconscionable. And it points up really profound cultural defects that allow that kind of thing to happen. But I believe, as you believe, in the very, very powerful piece you wrote in The Atlantic that I recommend to everyone, that the issue transcends the discomfort of the discriminated against, but goes to the broader culture that allows that kind of thing to happen. Karl Popper wrote very powerfully about the dilemmas for liberal society of tolerating everything except intolerance. And if tolerance extends to intolerance, where that ends and where that goes is something that is very, very problematic. And when we have leaders of our community giving convocation addresses in which they compare the founding of Israel, which they label the Nakba, with the Holocaust, and they are not reprimanded or called to account by anyone at the university, something is very profoundly wrong. When decisions made by faculty members to not discipline or overrule punishments that have been applied to people who have occupied property of the university in response to repeated warnings, something is very profoundly wrong. When a dean of the university feeds students burritos through the window while they occupy the university's central building of administration, something is very profoundly wrong. So I think that in our fixation with questions of comfort and questions of who is a victim, we have allowed political debate and dialogue to become a bit too much of a victimization Olympics. I thought it was unfortunate that the anti-Semitism report was juxtaposed with a report about Islamophobia, because we have to show equal sensitivity to victims in all groups. I think we have lost sight of the fact that one of the functions of universities is to actually sort out better ideas from worse ideas. Our biology department is not open to creationist scholarship. Our philosophy department is not open to scholarship from the Ayn Rand objectivist camp. Our medical school is not open to vaccine science denial. except insofar as in any of these cases, there is real and serious evidence and argument that is presented. And somehow, with respect to the idea that terrorism is okay or justified, with respect to the idea that it's okay to call for the elimination of a sovereign state, we seem to feel and emphasize that all ideas need to be heard respectfully and debated. And I think it's the job of university leaders not to punish anyone for what they say. Everybody's allowed to say whatever they wish. But the academic freedom does not include freedom from criticism. People have tenure as professors. They don't have tenure as university leaders or in positions of administrative authority. And I think that that obligation to maintain a culture is a very important part of the pursuit of truth, of veritas, and in important respects, the university has lost sight of that very, very important aspect. And if we continue to frame these questions just in terms of people's comfort, I think we will let down some of the values that are most fundamental.
So you know, I remember a chill going down my spine when one of your successors talked about honoring her own truth. And, you know, I said to myself, my God, you know, the motto of the university is not, you know, to everybody their own truth. It's truth, full stop. And I guess it, you know, it causes me to ask, you know, to what extent is this where we are now with universities? And obviously Harvard is far from alone. A result of failure of leadership at the top? Or is the result of kind of much deeper forces, you know, among the kinds of young people who come to universities, the attitudes of younger faculty, the attitudes of staff? And, you know, just as somebody who was a dean for a number of years, I'll say one of the things that I think is sometimes underestimated is the role that is played by professional staff at universities and, you know, fostering some of these behaviors. I mean, I'm sure there's a combination of sort of top-down issues and bottom-up issues. But, you know, how would you weight those? Because the thing that troubles me is if, as I believe, a lot of this is a kind of a bottom-up problem, appointing a few really, you know, courageous, visionary presidents will help, but they'll be a limit. I mean, somebody like Michael Roth at Wesleyan, who I think has been, you know, extremely articulate and very forceful and has laid out exactly the right values, or the counterpart at Vanderbilt has been similar. But you know, that will that be enough? And I guess I kind of have my doubts. I'd really like to hear what your view is.
You raise very good questions, and I don't have confidence in answers. I think the wrong group to blame is the students. In general, I have to say that I have enormous admiration and respect for the students I have the privilege of teaching, the vast majority of whom seem to me to be very thoughtful people who are very responsive to rational argument and want to be involved in open debate. So I'm sure that there are admissions offices from time to time who have overly rewarded instances of social activism and insufficiently rewarded detailed and thoughtful study in choosing who to admit. but I would put at the bottom of the list students as a source of the issue. I think that's an important difference between this moment or the moment in the last decade or two and the Vietnam War period, when you had the draft going and that had led to a kind of unreasonable radicalization among students. I think there is a problem with any institution that is governed by its staff, that when institutions are governed by their staffs, they have a tendency to inertia, to change slowly, to emphasize internal harmony and internal comfort relative to external impact. And so I think the institutions of faculty governance are almost calculated to make universities have problems in terms of being effective institutions. And there's a reason why most institutions in the society are structured in a less collective kind of way. I think in the case of universities, there's a very important selection aspect that enters, which could be put crudely this way. If you believe in capitalism, you have many, many choices in life. If you don't believe in capitalism and you don't like blood, you have many fewer career choices that you can make in life. And therefore, the set of people who find their way into the nonprofit sector tend to be selected for having a certain sort of attitudes. And by the way, that's especially true for people who are performing a set of tasks that exist in all sectors. If you want to be a theoretical physicist, there aren't many other places you can be besides a university. But if you want to be a manager of accounts, there are many, many places where you can be. And so if you choose a university as your environment, it probably speaks in some way to a variety of attitudes that you have. So I think the combination of internal governance with complete job security and the selection of who gravitates to this sector, that self-reinforcing aspect is, I think, an important contributor. And I think it's been mitigated over time. I think it's been made more true over time by another aspect that is enormously positive, which is if you looked 50 or 75 years ago, many of the people who went into academia were, given how poorly professorial positions and the like paid, were the children of very wealthy, almost aristocratic kinds of families who inherited the conservative biases of those families. That's no longer an important aspect of who goes to work as faculty or administration in universities. And so that conservative counterweight has, I think, been removed. So I think all of those things are aspects in terms of understanding what it is that has happened. But I think one has to be very, very careful about some of what people say. I mean, people say there's discrimination against conservatives, therefore we need to have affirmative action for conservatives. Well, you know, do we really want to be in the business of having ideological litmus tests for each person that you hire? I rather doubt that we do. Certainly, I can't imagine that it's going to make things better to have the government be the applier of those ideological litmus tests. So I think that one also needs to be very, very careful in thinking about these problems of the Hippocratic Oath about first do no harm. And so it seems to me that there are conservatives who view these issues. Christopher Rufo would be an extreme example, who ignore the central conservative truths of Edmund Burke about the dangers of identifying a problem and proposing radical change to fix it, and the many ways in which that can work out to lead to outcomes that are even worse than the problem was. As I think you wrote, you can frame a guilty man, and that doesn't make framing okay. And so I think none of what we have been saying should be taken as any justification for the entirely extra-legal approach that the Trump administration is taking. We are a country where if you are caught on videotape committing a violent crime, no punishment can be administered to you without a due process hearing, without notice, without being represented by a lawyer, without a whole variety of safeguards. And so the approach that's being taken of simply threatening and actually carrying through the removal of previously promised funding is, I think, entirely untenable as a solution to these problems. And I think those of us who have been concerned about the epistemic aspects of universities, and I completely agree with you that there is something deeply wrong and offensive about the phrase "my truth." And the more academic responsibility a person has, the more offensive it becomes when they utter it. I agree with you completely on all of that. But all of us who think that, it seems to me, have an enormous obligation to be clear that what we are seeing in the Trump administration's interaction with universities is not some kind of appropriate response to these concerns, but is instead using these concerns as a pretext for a stifling of potential opposition of a kind that is familiar from history as democracies are undercut.
You mentioned earlier, correctly, I think, that inflation had been a big part of the 1968, 1980, and of course, 2024 elections. In the 68 election, what was going on campuses was having a pretty big impact as well. I was reminded of that recently by, I've been reading a biography of another distinguished Harvard PhD, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And of course, he was at Columbia in 68 when a lot of this was going on, and had my own experience with this and my own misspent youth at Cornell in the late 60s and early 70s. So I wonder how much you think that the disorder on campuses last year kind of also contributed politically, and has also made universities particularly vulnerable to this kind of overreach by the Trump administration, because I do get a sense from, you know, talking to just people in my own community that there is this, I think, feeling that the Ivy League universities have become so detached from the experience of ordinary Americans that there's something bad going on there, and maybe the Trump administration isn't totally wrong to try and fix it. I wonder how you would respond to that.
So I'm not sure. And let me give you both sides of the story as I think about it. The clearest example in support of what you said, of which I'm aware, Eric, is I think it's relatively settled historical fact that Ronald Reagan won the 1966 gubernatorial election in California and launched his political career very substantially on the strength of the argument that the protesting students at Berkeley should be made to get haircuts, and protesting radicalism and pointing up what's happening on campuses. And so I don't minimize that as a political force, and the fact that we recognize the phrase silent majority of Spiro Agnew's 50 years later, and that George Wallace did as well as he did in Democratic primary elections, talking about pointy-headed intellectuals, and the fact that Richard Hofstadter wrote a famous book about anti-intellectualism in American life. All of that speaks to there being force in what you say. On the other hand, I now spent a few months each winter in Arizona for a few years. And believe it or not, I meet large numbers of people who go whole months, who go whole years without ever thinking about the Ivy League. And so I think there is some tendency on the part of those of us who have been associated with these institutions to assume a kind of centrality in our national life and focus on these institutions that may well be excessive. And so I think it would be stretching things to attribute the outcome of the election to the kinds of protests that are being described. I think a different question, that's a much deeper question, is whether ideas that have come out from these institutions over time have profound effects. Critical theory was an intellectual underpinning for a large amount of diversity activity that over time too often morphed into blatant reverse discrimination of a kind that badly undercut support for progressive causes. I think that's a fair argument, but that's a somewhat different argument than the one you made, which I think is quite easy for those of us who spend our time in these institutions to exaggerate.
I'd like to take that and maybe broaden out a little bit, and unfortunately we're coming to the end of our time. I suppose I should begin by saying I suspect you agree that the challenge in a way is to both sort of reform the universities in the way they need to be reformed while at the same time pushing back on what I view at any rate as pure vandalism on the part of the Trump administration going after them. But there's an even larger question, I think, which has to do with the role of universities in American public life. The extent to which, say, presidents of universities are viewed as people who are appropriately national figures speaking on matters of national concern, which these institutions, I'm not talking about the Ivies or anything like that, but in general, in which universities are somehow integrated into public life in ways that we really appreciate. Now, maybe this was just an artifact of World War II and everything that happened thereafter, because for sure, you know, people like Conant and James Finney Baxter and a lot of other academic leaders at the time ended up playing a very important role in the war effort, and that really carried on beyond, well beyond. Or, you know, if you look at figures like Kissinger or Brzezinski, you know, you have academics who are playing or my own mentor, Sam Huntington, they are public figures, and they're playing an important role. And I just somehow have a sense that that's sort of not where the universities are now. Now, I don't know whether that's a good thing or not. I don't know if that was a product of a moment, but could you just help us think through that? What should we want the universities and their leaders and their most distinguished faculty to be in American public life?
Here are some aspects of that very profound question, Elliot. One, I think it's very important to distinguish between faculty members and university officials. When Sam Huntington expressed opinions, he expressed them on behalf of Sam Huntington with some credentialing associated with the fact that he was a professor at Harvard, but he did not express them on behalf of Harvard University. He did not express them in a way which would lead somebody else at Harvard University to think that they were not allowed to express a different opinion. I think matters are quite different when you're speaking about the president of a university, or matters are quite different when you're speaking about someone who's running the university center on the Middle East. I think if you're running the university center on the Middle East and you're speaking on behalf of the university center on the Middle East, you should probably not be expressing a controversial political or policy opinion. So I would distinguish between universities as communities that include prominent public intellectuals and university leaders speaking on behalf of the university. And I think the impulse that often is referred to as the Calvin principles, where they were first articulated at the University of Chicago during the Vietnam War period, to very substantial caution about institutional statements is largely a warranted one. And certainly during my time as president of Harvard, I tried not to join in the political and policy issues of the day, speaking as president of Harvard. And I think that was an appropriate stricture. I think no one could dispute the idea that it's important for leaders of institutions to speak to issues bearing on the future of those institutions. And there is a fine line as to what is a policy statement and an intervention in politics, and what is a statement of institutional values. And I think we have probably tilted too far away from statements of institutional values in favor of a kind of generalized neutrality. I had occasion to reread recently a speech that Harvard President Conant gave the day after Hitler invaded Poland. At a time when the United States was not involved in World War II, he spoke of Harvard's obligation at that moment to be upholding the torch of liberty and free inquiry. And as a Harvard person, I was very proud that Harvard presidents at that moment did that. And I think that we did not manage a similar response after the glorification of terror on October 7th. And so I think the pendulum has tilted too far, but I would want to emphasize that I do think when you're speaking on behalf of a community, especially a community that venerates open inquiry and the role of iconoclastic ideas, you have to be very careful in the way in which you speak. And I think there is a separate question, which is a kind of a second order question on which I sort of go back and forth in my own mind, which is the role of large public intellectuals and public commentators within universities. And at some moments, I regret that there aren't more. At other moments, I think to myself that in an increasingly specialized world with more and more division of labor, perhaps it's appropriate that the task of commenting on economic policy and the task of teaching PhDs research techniques are more separated today in our society than they were in the time of Paul Samuelson and Milton Friedman. And so I am frankly not altogether sure, as someone who myself has tried to be a substantial participant in public debates while also being committed to participating in the scholarly enterprise for its own sake. In general, I think that universities need to be quite careful of a kind of symmetry principle. If we want the broader society not to try to push us around, we probably need, as institutions, to be very cautious about trying to push the broader society around. And so I tilt a bit more than I think the tone of your question was to the ivory tower view of universities, though I would hope that taking that ivory tower view would be consistent with a bit more recognition of what I called, when I was president, our institutional citizenship obligations as citizens of the United States.
Well, we could, I think, continue this conversation for, you know, another hour, if not more, but we have come to the end of our time. But I think it's fitting that we ended on a note of defense of the ivory tower, which I think deserves defending. So, Larry Summers, thank you so much for joining us on Shield of the Republic. I think certainly the issues that we touched on at the beginning about economics and certainly the life of the mind at the university are going to continue to be with us. So I hope from time to time we can have you back on Shield of the Republic.
Thank you very much. I would look forward to that.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.